Our guest today is not Indiana Jones. He's much better looking. And he's real. He's not David Attenborough. He's much younger. And he's here. But by heavens, he's in that business. He's right there in the line from dinosaurs to Darwin. He was born in Melbourne. Can't be perfect. Made his name at La Trobe and Monash Universities. Then he took off as principal research scientist at the Australian Museum in Sydney. And most recently, he's been explaining to the Americans that creationism has its minor problems. Many of us know him through his books, where he has brilliantly camouflaged deep research and thinking behind an easy and attractive style, particularly his research into Australia's vanishing mammals. It's just a technique for plane trees in Adelaide. It's a terrible thing. The ABC introduced him to a much wider audience through the six-part TV documentary on his book, The Future Eaters. And his books, I just noticed in the new list from Mary Munns, The Birth of Sydney, Tim Flannery, written in his easy-to-understand manner, Tim Flannery has captured the essence of the new colonial capital and its growth from a convict settlement. Paperback, $24.95. I'm sure you can buy one of those. He is here now to take the South Australian Museum to new heights when it reopens in March. Ladies and gentlemen, the director of the South Australian Museum, Dr. Tim Flannery.
Thanks very much, Don, and thank you all for coming. Perhaps I should. I'm feeling a bit strangulated. Blow it home, Gunner. After all of that mucking about, I thought... Apparently these started life as rags worn around the necks of Hungarian mercenaries, and they used to use them just to clean their guns. So this is my kind of symbol. Yeah. Sorry, my symbol to peace and whatever else. All right. Look, I thought what I'd talk about today was the thoughts I've had over the last 12 months about living in three very different places, which is Sydney, Boston in the States, and Adelaide. Now, I'm not intrepid enough to spend a lot of time on Adelaide, especially since I'm here and I've only spent 7 weeks in the city. But I thought I'd just have a look at the development of the different cultures that we live in, because Australia is a very, very different place from America, particularly the East Coast and the Northeast, that area around New England. And that difference, I think, is due in part to the environmental, differing environmental histories of those two continents and the colonial histories of them. Sydney is probably one of the strangest cities in the world. It was, from the moment it was conceived, it was this place of immense interest to everyone. You've probably all heard the ballads to Botany Bay and all the rest of it. Well, no one was ever sent to Botany Bay. That whole thing about Botany Bay and going to Botany Bay was generated from the initial interest when the government plans were to send people there. All of the convicts went to Port Jackson or somewhere else in Australia. So that gives you some sense that 2 centuries later we're still talking about Botany Bay. It's just due to 1787 and the public perception of what was happening. And when you think about founding this city, you're sending 1,500 people. You're sending 1,000 of them are felons and the rest of their jailers, essentially, halfway around the world to the last continent outside the realm of British Imperial Dominion. And you're expecting them to set up something there, and you're watching to see what happens. Is it possible to redeem these felons? Will they actually, you know, come back into the fold? What's going to happen to the local people? Is it possible to redeem the indigenous people? Get them to wear clothes and be good yeoman farmers? Everyone who came to Sydney, starting with those first American whalers in about 1789 or 1791, everyone from then on had the microscope on the city. And they report the most amazing things, I think. They report about the fertility of aged women, how all these grey-haired women are suddenly giving birth to kids, even these whores and various others who've never been infertile all their lives. All of a sudden, this new climate, they're giving birth to kids. And all the kids look the same. They've all got blonde hair and dark eyes. And you know, they see this. Everyone is watching very, very closely to what's happening in this city. So the wealth of material about early Sydney is really quite fascinating. And I guess from the very moment the city is born, you start seeing this kind of larrikin, knockabout, you know, well, bugger you, mate, sort of attitude. And it's very different here in Adelaide because you haven't had that convict beginning. If I could just... I am indeed. If I could... it really, what I decided to do was rather than look at the virtues people were espousing, those like Governor Phillip and whatever, who say this is what we want it to be, you look at what they were condemning, you look at the crimes of the city, because that's what gives you the real insights into what's close to people's hearts. So I went back to the historic record and thought, where is the first crime committed on Australian soil, according to British law, of course? And there it is, 10 days after settlement. People have gone into Botany Bay. The convict men have been very busy over the last 10 days, and there's about 800 of them, and there's less than 200 women. They've been kept apart on the hulks and in prisons for more than a year, Helen Senator. And the men are sent ashore to clear the grounds and set up the tents, and they set up this convict women's camp. And then, about 4 o'clock in the evening, they start disembarking the women. And the women all go ashore. They're given a thorough search to recover the numerous items stolen from various crew members and whatever during that voyage, none of which can be found, unfortunately. And some of them look quite good. They've managed to get some new clothes. They've kept for the voyage, and they're all going ashore. Strictly guarded, of course, to go into their new compounds. Just as they get ashore, 6 o'clock in the evening, one of those prodigious Sydney thunderstorms hits, which none of the Europeans has experienced anything like before in their lives. A great lightning bolt comes down and blinds the sentry who's looking after the women's camp, knocks him to the ground and blinds him temporarily. The sheep are electrocuted, the pigs run off in disgrace. Governor Phillip and the various other notables are kind of cringing in their cabins in the boats, waiting for this terrible catastrophe of nature to pass, because they don't know what's going to happen. They've seen all these burnt trees and they think they've been struck by lightning. You see, they think their lives are at risk. And the worst thing that could have happened was that the captain of the female convict ship was so pleased to get rid of these troublesome women that he'd given an extra serve of grog to all of his sailors. So they had this bloody great lot of rum, and they're all pissed as newts on the deck. They've shared it around. Everyone's bloody had, you know, they're very high. So the sun's around, they're singing, oi, 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 you know, and the storm's all around them. And of course, it wasn't too long before the grog gets ashore to the convicts and to the convicts' women, you see, convict women. And we only have a few accounts of what passed that night, but one of them is by Lieutenant Ralph Clark, who kind of, presumably was looking as the lightning striking, as kind of illuminating this scene like a little breeze, you know. And he says, my God, what a scene of boredom is there in the convict women's camp. You know, you know, shocking things going on in the mud and everyone drunk and carrying on. So the next morning, Governor Phillip thinks, look, we're on the edge, we're away from the known universe here, there we are on the edge of South O'Connor, I've got to regain control. So he gets his papers, royal and everything else together in their lovely little leather boxes and decides he's going to do a muster for the whole of the camp. So he goes down to the convict women's camp, well, not him, but his marines go down, and they drag out one hungover convict after the other out of these women's camps. And you can imagine the kind of conversation that goes on. Oh, leave me alone, you know, I don't want to be there. And women coming out, convict women, oh, you can kiss my sea, is what they often said to the sailors. You know. Very, very volatile kind of affair. But anyway, kicking everyone in the line. Till finally they get to one tent and open it up and drag out the carpenter from the Prince of Wales transport. And this is a very serious business, because there's like about 24 respectable people in the whole settlement, you see. They have one of them kind of participating in this is a terrible thing. So you imagine the carpenter severely reprimanded and warned, this is not the right thing to do. You know, he'll probably be visited by the lash tomorrow. Anyway, the convict woman comes out swearing, presumably, you know, into the mud, into the light of day with her blooming shawl around her and whatever else, cursing at the Marines. And next comes out of the very same tent, the cabin boy from the Prince of Wales transport, dressed in a woman's petticoat. Now this left poor old Governor Phillip with a dilemma. He didn't know whether, you know, the old grand naval tradition of rum, bum and harmonium was being honoured on the new shore, or whether in fact the carpenter had been in with the convict woman. Nothing could be determined with any accuracy. So instead of the lash, he was spared the lash and was made to parade out of the settlement to the tune of the Rogues March. Now, I don't know whether you've ever heard the Rogues March. It's one of the most beautiful, lilting, mocking tunes played with the pipes in all of the 18th century repertoire of the British military. It's a wonderful piece. And it's what they'd play when you're whipped around the fleet or you were killed or something awful was going to happen to you. But on this stage, there they are, the mud of Sydney, 1,000 hungover convicts, the Marines all in their red, you know, up there, Governor Phillip with his patents royal and everything else. And this procession goes by. First the flutes, then the carpenter with his hands tied in front of him like this, walking along, then the convict woman, and then at the back the cabin boy, still in his petticoats, kind of marching into the mud. And what do they face at the end of the little cut out area? I mean, what is there? There's 2,000 kilometres or 2,000 miles of eucalypts and nothing. So what do you do? Do you send them out or do they just turn around and come back in? And of course, that's exactly what happened. This amazing parody, I think, of the gay and lesbian Mardi Gras, you know, 2 centuries earlier, this incredible kind of event. And a still fulminating Governor Phillips says at some stage, you know, well, the next case of sodomy found in my settlement will be punished by sending the miscreants to be eaten by the Maori to New Zealand. And you wonder whether even meat exports in those days might have had their difficulties. Did the Maori know what they were getting when they were getting these bloody exports? And as it turns out, when you read the documents, various convicts were eaten by the Maori, including one alias Ratty Ray, who disappeared that way at some stage soon after. So we don't know what happened to poor Ratty, but he may have been sent there for his own good or the good of the settlement or some such. But anyway, the thing that's really important to me in all of that early history is that the essence of Sydney is set from the very beginning. This bawdy, reckless, sybaritic port town, which isn't facing Europe at all. It's left Europe behind. It's facing this grand Pacific, this huge unknown. And from the moment that it appears there, from the moment it's settled, everyone in the Pacific knows about it. Within 10 years of that settlement, the Tongan royal family have come to visit. The Te Pahi, the great chief from the Bay of Islands, has come to Sydney to visit. Spanish prize ships are being sold and have been captured off the Chile coast are being sold in Sydney. Mohammedans are having the bloody festival of Hassan, you know, and wowing the whole city with this incredible Asian festival. It's an extraordinary place. It's lost its European roots. It's been cut loose into the middle of the Pacific. The Americans are more important than the British. They're the ones who keep coming trading these New England whalers and whatever. And to avoid port fees, of course, none of them go into Port Jackson. They're all going up into the Hawkesbury River and sending their little lighters around to the main settlement. So it's an extraordinary place from the beginning. Within about 40 years of that, the British have recaptured Sydney. Mass migration, free migration into Sydney has changed the city totally. And you read people like Moody, Terry, the commentators of the time who were there in the 1830s who see this. What they say about Sydney is it's just like any other English port city you've ever seen, except that it's more English. And I think it's Terry that says, the only reason that I knew I wasn't in Portsmouth when I was there was that we had a meal of kangaroo and mangoes or some tropical fruit one day. You know, it's just so British. And at that time, of course, the flies are an unbearable horror. Flies everywhere. The First Fleet has never mentioned flies as a problem. Mosquitoes by the ton. Hordes, we can't have a bloody picnic without mosquitoes. Snakes. The First Fleet has doubted there were any poisonous snakes in Australia. Within a couple of decades of settlement, they're into the bloody hospital biting patients. They're everywhere. These brick fielders, these phenomenal wings that just built up on the horizon like a great wall of dust and swept through the city, or a feature of the city that was just never there before. Bushfires are a problem. So what you see has happened is that the ecology of Sydney has broken down almost irretrievably. Sewerage, water, disruption to drainages, denudation of the vegetation, infestation of rats that attract snakes, all of these things have transformed what was once a paradise for people into a hellhole. And it really was. It was very British, but by God, it was an awful place to live, with disease and snakes and flies and mozzies and everything else. It was pretty bloody awful. It took us about 2 centuries to get beyond that point. The next Muslim festival that occurred in Sydney after 1806 was probably in about 1980, Turkish immigrants coming in. It took us a long time to get over that and start to become Australians rather than people from somewhere else. But that initial look at Sydney with its first gay and lesbian Mardi Gras and its first sort of Pacific focus really gives me heart, because that's where I'd actually like to be. That's where I'd like the city to be rather than a pale reflection of another European city. So my hatred of plane trees kind of comes from that particular focus that the totally British settlement, you can do it, and it was done in Sydney in the 1830s, but the costs are so high that no one in their right mind would ever consider doing it. I think who's lived here for any time. So that was what I was doing as I wandered off to Boston to teach at Harvard University for a year. And in what I thought was basically the same society, you know, America and Australia, very, very similar. I got to Boston and no one laughed at my jokes. People kept on saying, you can't say that, or something like that. No black fella would speak to me, very different to in Australia, where they'll speak to you all too readily. It was kind of like, just a totally different society. And so I started thinking, how can I understand this society? How can I figure out what America is really about? Well, I started 65 million years ago looking at the way the continent was put together revolutionary, and I won't bore you with that this afternoon because you've all had lunch and you'll just get indigestion if I go into that. But essentially, I used the same trick that I used in Sydney. I thought, to understand this society and a settlement, we've got to look at the first, what they hated. What was the first crime committed in New England? Now, I've just got to warn you a bit that in fact, you all know, don't you, that America was settled by the Pilgrim Fathers? When they arrived in North America, the University of Mexico was 70 years old. Mexico was, in fact, a magnificent European-style city with all the grandeur of somewhere like Seville or wherever else. In fact, Virginia had been settled 13 years before by a group of adventurers. The Puritans are just a fiction. They're invented. They didn't settle America for the Americans. It's just the Americans happened to like Puritan values and decided they were the first in. So they're our forefathers. And if you ever go down to Plymouth in Massachusetts and have a look at what they've done, it's the most wonderful reconstruction of history you'd ever want to see. There's an enormous cupola erected by the shore, and it was put up in 1921 by the Society of Colonial Dams. Now, I don't know. The Americans are the most peculiar lot, but this really takes the cake, I tell you. And off on a little kind of a pier off the edge of that is the Mayflower. Beautiful, floating in the harbour, looks just like the Mayflower. Trouble is, it's a pure invention. No one knows what the Mayflower looks like. There's no good descriptions, there's no plans, there's nothing. This is history reinvented. On the hill above this cupola, with all of the sacred stone that the first pilgrims stepped ashore on, is a great big statue of an American Indian about 20 feet bloody high, erected by the Improved Order of Red Men, purporting to represent Massasoit, the sachem of the area, at the time that all this was happening. And there's a sarcophagus next to it, and the sarcophagus has all of the bones of the Pilgrim Fathers in it, so we're led to believe. And those bones had been thrown under the cupola for many years as they'd eroded out of the seashore and whatever else, and were just left there under this rock. I've got to tell you about the rock, though, because the rock, this Plymouth Rock, you know, very famous place where they first stepped ashore, and this is what the big cupola was over, you know. It's an erratic, glacial erratic boulder, probably arrived in place 12,000 years ago, at the end of the Ice Age, from somewhere up in Canada, and broken in half to make way for a road and thrown away and then found again and kind of glued together and all the rest of it. But the reason it's so sacred to these people is that the man called Thomas Faunce, in his 95th year, recognised it as the place that his father had told him that the Puritans first stepped ashore. The records unfortunately show that Thomas Faunce's father, even if he had a good memory, arrived 3 years before any pilgrim, after the first settlement of the place. So it's all very bloody dubious. I wouldn't believe a word of it. But when you get to this sarcophagus with the bones in it, there's some lovely dobro around the outside of it. It ends with a tribute to the pilgrims, and it says of them in quotes, "who laid the foundation of a state wherein every man should have liberty to worship God in his own way." Now, if any of you know anything of Puritan history, you'll know that that would make them every bone turn in its grave, because that's exactly what they didn't want. They knew how to worship God. They had left England because the revolution there, the establishment of the Church of England, didn't go far enough. Many of them left England. They went to the Netherlands, which had a more enlightened look. They were the people who really did believe everyone could worship God in their own way. So the Puritans take up there. They find they can't make a living because in this very dense ecology of the Netherlands, there's very few jobs available for people who don't speak Dutch. So they end up living in a place called Stink Alley in Leiden, doing a few odd jobs, cleaning out the sewers and stuff probably. And finally decide they've had enough of that, and half of them go off to the New World to settle this New World. The half that stay behind, within a generation, they're Dutchmen. There's no more Puritans, they're just Dutch. The half that go to North America become the founding fathers of this great society. I couldn't have given this talk in the States for reasons that are probably already clear. But looking at this history, I thought, all right, what's the first crime that's committed in this very God-fearing society? It turns out that the first criminal in New England was a certain John Lyford, preacher. He was the local vicar, the first one ever to arrive, who soon after his disembarkation was accused of disorderly walking and being tangled in many corruptions. And it's left at that. So we don't know what he was doing. But we learn from the long-suffering Puritans of the time that eventually Mr. Lyford grew very perverse, which was a grim sign. And in 1625, just 5 years after they landed, John Lyford and his fellow preacher, known colloquially as Mad Jack Oldham, were punished. So we don't know what Mad Jack did, but he obviously wasn't very popular. And they were forced to run Ye Gantelope, which consisted of Ye Thump on Ye Breech with Ye End of Ye Musket, and sent back to England. And I can't find out what they did wrong. That's the trouble. It's very obscure what they actually did. But as far as I can tell, their worst offence was some sort of minor theological peccadillo. Like, you know, they had some slight disagreement with the church in New England about what the kind of the true way was. But the pilgrims didn't have much luck after that initial appointment. They then managed to recruit a Mr. Rogers, who arrived in 1628. And Mr. Rogers was soon found to be, as the records say, crazed in his brain, and he was sent home soon after. So again, we don't still have an idea of what's going on here in this society. In 1636, they managed to get someone else, the long-suffering Mr. Rayner, but even he finally gave up in 1654 and went back to England. In the meantime, they managed to recruit the Reverend Mr. Chauncey, who arrived in 1641, who was, as far as I can tell, a rather eccentric and dogmatic fellow. He saw no benefit in sprinkling water on those to be baptised. Instead, he took to tossing infants into the baptismal font, as far as I can tell, from some distance away. And upon the baptism of twins, when one of them swooned, the enraged mother rushed at him and precipitated him into his own baptismal font, apparently. And soon after, he was appointed president of Harvard University. But anyway, it was a very strange sort of kind of... But the point I want to make of this is that all of the crimes, bar one, in early New England were ecclesiastical. So what's really important to people here is not sodomy in the lash or anything else. It's actually towing a line with religion. The only exception I could find to this terrible litany of crimes, which were, we wouldn't think terribly much of at all, was in 1642, when the long-suffering William from Bradford, who was the kind of chronicler of these various events, reported that wickedness did grow and break forth. And this is an interesting crime coming up here. In fact, the wickedness was so horrible that it precipitated a debate of deep concern to the whole community. The awful offence wasn't murder or robbery, as you might expect, but of a young man called Thomas Granger, who'd been caught red-handed with a filly. The trouble was, it really was a filly. It was of the equine type. And upon being questioned over this, he admitted to it being rather too intimate with the cow, 2 goats, 5 sheep, 2 calves and a turkey. Now, the turkey's the mystery object. But anyway, so the Puritans were in a shocking state because they knew that they'd left Holy Europe, where at least, you know, God and Christianity were understood. And when they came to America, all they saw was barbarians, these terrible Indians who hadn't heard the word of God, these animals that were strange and peculiar and different seasons, and they were very worried that the devil was very strong in America. And so they had this kind of, they got young Thomas and took him aside and said, but where did you get the idea from to do all of this? Because, you know, if it had just come out of the ether, they might all be susceptible, you see, they might all fall the same way. But it turns out that young Thomas, to their great relief, admitted to having learned his advice from 2 inveterate horse buggerers who had just arrived from Merry England, where they'd enjoyed a long career in the countryside of their particular pleasures. But anyway, so that was a great relief to the Puritans of the time. But so horrid was the crime that they decided that everyone who'd been involved had to be punished. So they got the horse red-handed along with young Thomas. The cow wasn't a problem. The goats and sheep, well, they had to parade the whole flock in front of him, and he said, that one? So those ones got pulled out and cast into the pit, as they said in those days. A terribly sad speech there was. But given their preoccupation about the powers of the devil in North America, I find it remarkable that the only one to escape the barnyard bacchanalia was the turkey, the only Native American involved. Everything else was imported. The turkey was the only native species involved, and there's no record of him being cast into the pit. So I can only think from that either he had a lucky escape or the pilgrims had already enjoyed him at the last Thanksgiving. I don't know which it was, but anyway, he didn't. Bad biology was also a very serious problem for these pilgrims. They were so worried about towing the line that they do regular checks of the pig herd, the pig flocks. And in a village which had some dissent in it, just say someone decided that the Reverend Thomas Lyford perhaps wasn't towing, wasn't so bad as he was painted, or perhaps that John Winthrop, governor of Massachusetts, was a bit out. They'd send the old inspector of the pig flocks around, and he'd have a look and say, "Oh, that piglet there hasn't got much fur on it. Look, he's got a sty in his eye, just like young Fred over here, the main malefactor of the community." And of course, you know, and this actually happened on several occasions, and John Winthrop just casually announces they put him to death, you know, buggering the pigs off with his head or whatever happened to him. So the witch trials of Salem in 1690, which is 70 years after all of this, 50 years after, there's no surprise. This is just an ongoing, in-looking society. So my take of it was I was just so bloody glad we got the convicts and they got the Purims, because, I mean, terrible, terrible difference. So that was my kind of indoctrination into the society. But I do want to speak about the thing that interested me most in terms of being in America. There's no doubt in the current world that the United States of America is the sole world superpower and the global powerhouse for the economy and the main disseminator of ideas in the world. Now, how did that come to be? I naively went to America thinking that was always the case, that North America was always like that. It turns out that it wasn't. And if I need to just paraphrase 50 million years of world history and hope that you'll believe me by saying that for the last 50 million years of world history, America has contributed virtually nothing to the world. Everything has come out of Eurasia. That's just the fact of it. If you take the long view, North America has produced dogs, camels, and horses. Da-da-da! And the world has produced everything else. So, and dogs, camels, and horses share some very interesting things in common. The first is that they're all our major domesticates, and that isn't an accident. They left North America, by the way, many millions of years before people were ever thought of, got out the successful escapees from North America into the rest of the world. The second is that they're all great scungers in one way or another. Great budget. That's true. They are there. Dogs have the most strange breeding system in the world. The whole pack doesn't breed. Among wolves, it's just the two dominants that breed. And if you want to look at any other organisms that do this way, then what they're doing is the two best animals breed and everyone else in the pack helps feed the young. The only other place you see that's in Australia among birds on any scale, where everything from blue wrens to kookaburras, they live in social groups and only the two dominants breed and everyone else feeds the young. And that happens in really stressed environments, in environments where there's not enough food, but where food is so thinly spread that two adults can't feed their young, so you need more than two adults to feed the group. So dogs are like that. Camels, of course, are proverbial for their ability to get by on scungy rations and live in terrible deserts, or live on the high altiplano of South America with their llamas and whatever else. Horses, of course, are very strange in that they're the only hindgut fermenters on the planet that are very fast. And that particular niche opens them up in ways I can't elaborate on here, to living in very scungy environments, to living on the edge in limited environments. You can put a horse on pasture that, for example, a cow can't live on. A cow needs relatively small volumes of very high quality food. Horses need lots and lots of fairly crappy food. They can pump it through quickly. So that's the 50 million years. But if we come back just to human times, it's clear, isn't it, that over the last 11,000 years since people have been in the New World, and I should say that the New World was the last landmass to be entered by people. People didn't go from America into Eurasia, they went from Eurasia into America. As part of a global expansion of Mongoloid people, East Asian people, who were the most recently evolved people on the planet, who at the end of their Great Basin expansion had occupied something like 70% of the habitable surface of the globe. So here we're seeing the importance of Eurasia against North America. At the same time that those early Indians come into North America, along with them, or soon after, come grizzly bears, And he thought they were American. That's just a load of rubbish. They're Eurasian, born of their brown, faintly Asiatic brown bears. Bison. The bison that live in North America now are just European Eurasian wisent that have come in probably after people arrived. Elk, we think, are in the same basket. We haven't got the fossil record quite right yet, but elk appear to be the same. Moose, of course, are another Eurasian migrant. In fact, if you look at the North American fauna and try to find the biggest animal that's actually native, you get down to something the size of the American black bear or the antelope, which are little piddly things the size of our kangaroos, maybe a little bit bigger. So America is just, as far as this big animals goes as people, it's just an adjunct of Asia. Always has been the recipient, never the exporter, never the gross exporter. So how is it that in the last 300 years of history, the whole trend of global evolution and world history has been reversed? How is it that North America has been able to take over the globe? That comes down to one great question to me, which is, why wasn't Columbus Chinese? Well, you might think it a funny question, but just think about it. Every other invasion into North America was from Asia. It was the American Indians, the Athapascan people, the Inuit, the Eskimo, and ongoing invasions after that. The West Coast has got the most equitable climate. It's the richest in resources in America. It's the sort of place that you'd think people would settle first. Like in the 19th century, Japanese fishermen are constantly being washed up on the coast of California. It's not like it's a long way away. It's almost a continuous landmass. You look at that question, why wasn't the route, as it had always been for the last 50 million years of Earth history, why wasn't the route from the east? Why was it that this inhospitable, vast ocean of the Atlantic was crossed by a European before Asian people came into the west coast of the States? And that is the key to understanding, I think, what happened to America after that. I don't hold the answers to those questions, or if I do, it's too bloody short this afternoon to go into them. But I would just like to say that the person who did settle North America for the English, John Smith, who settled the Virginia settlement, Jamestown, in 1607, spent his early youth fighting in the middle of Germany. And he wasn't fighting other Europeans, he's fighting Asians. He's fighting the Tartar, the Turk, various Asian invading armies into Europe, in the middle of what we now consider Europe, well, well west of what we consider the dividing line. That history is just so common for Europe. The Neanderthals, if you want to go back 100,000 years, evolved in Asia, Central Asia. They made their last stand on Gibraltar 29,000 years ago, so they've been pushed to the west. The Indo-European language groups and the Celts evolved in Central Asia, made their last stands on the western islands of Europe, the Irish and others, just in historic times. In 1600, we were in the middle of another great invasion. The forces of Central Asia were again pushing the remnant peoples off to the west when John Smith made his stand in Central Germany. Yes, we'd had a minor win in Spain, but nothing to speak of. And then the New World's discovered, and what happens? The tables are suddenly reversed. All of a sudden, the world takes an utterly different shape. Asia is no longer the centre, this great pulsating centre of Europe, of expansion for everything from grizzly bears to cultures. All of a sudden, the Europeans do this great encirclement. They kind of outflank everyone else and establish these great empires that in 1788 washed up on the shores of eastern Australia. The fuel that was necessary to do that was clearly of enormous volume. It actually took the trashing of a continent to achieve that. And if you look at North America's history, you can see that on that day in 1607, what lay before those people were countless buffaloes, a soil frontier which just dwarfed anything anyone had seen before, created by the Ice Age, several billion passenger pigeons, whatever else you want. And when you look at that American frontier history and the way people developed their response to it, you see that the slaughter of the buffalo was a necessary teething rusk to Ford, Henry Ford. You had to understand how to disassemble large organisms en masse in order to assemble large mechanical devices en masse. And there is a direct link there. Ford visited the abattoirs of Chicago to see how they worked. And that process began on the plains of the Midwest as people came across this phenomenal ecological bounty. What we have really in that encapsulated history is a people who really do believe there are no front, there are no boundaries. All there is frontiers. People who decide that the world is just open and ripe for exploitation, and who today are not surprisingly organising and driving the space race, because that's the next frontier. Not for any reason but a cultural one, because that's what they think is important. The sort of society and culture they've exported to the rest of the world has at its heart the idea that, in fact, people are the next frontier, that we, our pockets and our brains and our resources, are the next frontier to be tamed. And that, of course, has very important implications for us, because our trajectory was just very, very different. Our trajectory in Australia was one where, within a decade, probably, in any one location, the frontier had finished. There wasn't a long-sustained frontier experience to strip away our European heritage, as we saw 2 weeks ago at the election, the referendum, and to create this new can-do, tough man image that, you know, he who works fastest and hardest grabs the bounty of the frontier. What happened instead to us was things like the droughts of 1890, where everyone is crucified by the land, and people say, well, you know, I'm really glad that you've given me a piece of bread, or you've let my cattle bloom and graze on your bit of pasture over there. It builds this communal sense, this sense of mateship, this sense of society that I've never felt so strongly anywhere but in Adelaide. Here it's here where we're so close to that pulsating, erratic heart that drives people to destruction so often, that here the sense of society is very strong, less so in Sydney and Melbourne, but here it really is actually a very powerful force. So we stand at the conjunction of these two very different histories, this history starting with John Smith in 1607, beginning with the trashing of a continent and the export of that idea that you can actually overexploit resources limitlessly and identify new ones, and this sense of a small beleaguered group of people who were used to adversity, who somehow have developed a society that have helped them to cope with that adversity, but faced with a very, very different challenge from outside, whose orientation and philosophy and beliefs are utterly different and opposed to our own. I don't want this to sound like a chauvinistic sort of talk, because I've spent the last 12 months in both societies and think the Americans in many ways are wonderful. But their history and trajectory does really worry me. I think that the whole idea of American marketing and business development, as we see it there, is the use of people as a frontier. And if you look at the American frontier, you'll probably see what's in store for us all unless we do something. So thank you. Bye.
I think we're going to have an interesting time in the museum. Questions, please, from the media, and would you please name your organisation before you ask your question?
Thank you, Tim, for that wonderful exposition, and I think we really enjoyed the trip. Robert Maynes, my name, for the Baltimore Magazine. You've looked backwards there. Let me ask you to look forwards. I also spent some time in the United States. I worked for a couple of years for the Reader's Digest, a small American magazine, and had similar perhaps experience to you in a part of North America not very far away from Boston. So therefore, let me ask you to look forward. If we agree, and I think that you would agree, that the 20th century has been the American century, what is the 21st century? Who is going to belong to the 21st century? Who will dominate the 21st century?
That question is the most difficult one. I hope no one was going to ask, because it'll take a long answer. We saw the beginning of the 21st century in January this year with the launch of the euro, I think. And what the euro has done is developed a single market, or the beginnings of a single market for 330 million people in a developed landscape, if you want, in a developed economy. And to see the American response to that was very interesting. If you look back at Benjamin Franklin trying to set the groundwork for independence in 1760. This is before the revolution with the British. What he's saying to them is that, you know, we're going to grow very big, but we'll never be a threat to you. We'll never, ever be anything like England. We, you know, yes, we're going to have lots of people, but we're so loyal and we love you and we think you're wonderful and, you know, life is going to be rosy for all of us with us growing strong. I heard the chairman of the central bank speaking, European Central Bank speaking in January this year to the American audience, and he was saying exactly the same sort of thing. The euro will never, ever be a threat to the American dollar. Heaven forbid. It's so far from our minds, it's impossible, and it's not what we're on about, and just forget it, you know, we'll never be a threat to you. But you can see that size really does count, despite many of the women in the room will probably say that's not the case, but the men will agree that size does count, and the size of a particular economic unit is very important. So can I just say that, but the bigger question that you asked is why not East Asia, yeah? Why not the place that's been the powerhouse of global evolution for the last 40 million years, whose people settled 70% of the habitable globe before 5,000 years ago? What's happened to East Asia? And that is the great question that I'm really interested in. My sense of it is that it was the discovery and domestication of rice as a crop that destroyed East Asia. Once you had developed rice, wet rice agriculture as a crop, you could, within a very small area, 10 hectares, essentially, provide for the extended family unit. Or you could provide everything. You could provide all of the carbohydrate needs, all of the protein needs, and have a small surplus to buy in what you wanted. But that, because of the dynamics of rice agriculture, that unit was essentially indivisible. So what you get in East Asia is the development of primogeniture. You get number one son, number two son, number three son. Number one son is the inheritor of the rice plot. Number two and three do what they can to make a living, because that unit is indivisible. If you take that a bit further along, you develop ancestor worship, which is only the worship of the last number one son and the one before him. The whole East Asian political system is built on that base. The emperor is the ultimate number one son, just below God himself, and people below him are treated with the loyalty and devotion you treat a father, and the despotism that a father can bring to a family like that who is making decisions on the basis of primogeniture. That system destroys stability in life and destroys enterprise, because the person above you is basically given a license to use you as a resource, to take from you whatever they can. So the Mandarin or the party cadre or whoever it is, doesn't matter what the name of the system is, it's the same system, is able to stick his hand into your pocket and take what he wants. And individual enterprise is destroyed. That, of course, promotes gambling, because if you get a small windfall, that windfall is totally useless. All it does is mark you out as a particularly juicy morsel for you know, rape and pillage. But if you can convert that into a big enough resource to launch yourself into the next class up, you're safe. So gambling is a very, very important part of Asian culture because of that particular kind of structure. In this part of the world, Australia, New Guinea, we don't have political structures. You have clans, you know, and people. In New Guinea, the odd big man gets up, but doesn't stay up very long. He falls down. Europe treads the middle ground between those two extremes. Somehow in Europe, the lord or the king, all of the athelings and lords below him, the bishop, the yeoman, have all existed in this uneasy tug of war for power. And sometimes it does develop into a hierarchical, you know, dictatorship. Sometimes we do get a Hitler or a Napoleon, but it's unstable. It never lasts very long and collapses. Sometimes the whole system collapses into chaos, like New Guinea or Australia, and it's family-based, but that doesn't last very long either. For some reason, and I don't know what it is about the ecology of Europe, but I have my ideas, Europe is in this unstable state, steady yet unstable state, and it's the synergy of those various levels of power that create the sort of enterprise and the sort of capacity for us to take over. The fact that that didn't happen before we discovered America shows that just isn't enough. That would have been swept aside. If America didn't exist by now, Europe would be Asian, I think. I don't think there's any doubt about that. It would be pushed right up to the limits of the Western Isles if there was any of us left. So you need both that and the resource base, and that was the great synergy. East Asia has always had the resource base, It simply fell foul of rice agriculture 5,000 years ago, which stopped it developing further. So that's my answer to that question.
Yes, hello. Mark Steen, my name is up from the advertiser. I have a little bit of a concern that my question is frivolous after that. But I've lived in the States too. Why don't they get our jokes? Was it because I wasn't funny?
It's the Puritans. That's the I tried to figure that too. My first thing was maybe they don't understand the accent. They don't get the jokes. Second was maybe they get the jokes and think they're disgusting. Both of those turned out to be wrong, I reckon, because I actually made a few intimate American friends I would ask. The third is that they get them, but they're afraid to laugh at us. It's not laughing with us, it's laughing at us. So that was the problem. Our jokes are all, as my sister would say, self-deprecating. They're kind of, you know, jokes that rebound on us. And they're not the American sense of humour. They're not the way it goes. So,
did you experience the vacant looks? You'd pass a comment. I think Australians have a great irony. Yeah. And they just don't get irony.
I think it might have been embarrassment. I'm not sure.
Embarrassment for us?
Yeah. Well, yeah. I don't know. That was my take on that. Well, that's right. Yes, indeed. Yeah, that's right.
Christopher Galley, former ABC and News Limited journalist. I'll ask you to put on your crystal ball. How do you see the status of Australia compared with the status of the United States of America in the 21st century, and also having regard to the power of technology to wipe out employment? Has either country got any status at all in the 21st century?
That what we're seeing at the moment is it's a battle which has been going on in Europe since probably the 10th century. And it's a battle of the relative balance of power across the spheres. The church has now dropped out as a significant power. And it's still spelled locally, but really the churches are not a significant power anymore in Western societies, I'd argue. Which leaves two great groups which are opposed. One is the princes, or the political power structure, and the other is the kind of economic, the merchants side of it. And we're entering a phase where the merchants, the businesses, have gained the ascendancy in terms of power, or are rapidly gaining it, and are managing to squeeze the political systems, which are now democratic, into the shape they want. It's all too easy just to say, well, look, the merchants have won the day, and we're going to live in a world without barriers and without nations or whatever else. That isn't the experience of Europe over the last 5,000 years. You know, you can go back to the earliest dawn of agriculture in Europe, and you see the balance of power is there. So I don't think that's actually going to happen. I think that the merchants may gain the upper hand for some time, but that ultimately political power will still remain important. But in terms of the relative positions of the two powers, North America contains about 16% of the land surface of the globe, and it really is the choice spot. It's the North American glaciers of the last ice age, which was only 15,000 years ago, covered 18 million square kilometres of ground. At that time, the Antarctic glaciers only covered 13 million square kilometres, and those glaciers were fantastically important because they were moving. They were ripping up real estate like enormous ploughs, grinding rocks. Some of these rocks were 4 kilometres long that were being moved in these great masses of ice, grinding them into dust and distributing them at the end of the glacial streams across North America. So the soils that were created at that time, which is what the world still lives on, were of phenomenal extent. No other continent benefited from the last ice age like North America. Australia is the sandy patch, really, on the global agricultural scene. We had almost no glacial inputs. We have the worst soils by far. We have the most dramatic, erratic rainfall and the lowest amount of rainfall and runoff. So we'll always be a tiny European enclave on the edge of Europe. Now, that doesn't worry me. I mean, Aboriginal people survived here for 7,000 years after the Asian peoples arrived in Southeast Asia. And there's no doubt that Asia always knew about Australia. I mean, the Maori had a name for the damn place. They called it Ulimaroa. You know, people from Sulawesi were visiting regularly for various purposes. The Chinese seemed to know about the place. The fact is no one could make a living here because it's so bloody hard. If you have wet rice agriculture or taro agriculture or something, you can't do it. We're lucky that we had the blank. We were the first in. We had a few crops that might work and we had a subsidy from Europe. So I don't think there's going to be an Asian takeover at any time soon, as long as we keep the north empty. If we populate the north, we're in danger, I think. But if we keep it empty, I think we can survive. So we'll be small, we'll be a pimple on the backside of Asia, but, you know, we can make a living. America will always be a power, whether it's the world superpower or not, I doubt. I think it'll be third in line, ultimately, perhaps after Eurasia and Africa.
Thank you very much, Steve.
I don't know whether you drink red wine or not.
Only a bit. This may help you. It's a wonderful St. Hugo. It's wonderful.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thanks very much, Tim.